Towards the end of his life, Thomas Jefferson wrote a letter to a friend in which he took stock of the American religious landscape as seen through his eyes in the early 1820s. And he offered this observation and prediction: "I trust there is not a young man alive today who will not die a Unitarian." Don't know what he thought about women and young women, but that was what he said. Well, Jefferson was a brilliant man. Brilliance, however, does not guarantee accuracy or truth on all counts. He did have his blind spots, particularly one about religion that I'll get to later. Also, as you well know, had his blind spots when it came to slavery and fathering a child by a slave, but we can acknowledge that and keep it on the shelf for this morning. The man from Monticello apparently assumed that the principles and the ideals of the European Enlightenment that he had shared with such contemporaries as George Washington, Thomas Paine, and Benjamin Franklin were, to use a phrase he also inserted into the Declaration of Independence, self-evident truths. And he must have felt that these self-evident truths would in time just kind of become absorbed into the population at large by some kind of a cultural osmosis. And since Jefferson's deistic God and his take on Jesus as a moral exemplar, ideas that were very compatible with his Enlightenment views, were also tenets of Unitarianism in his day, he must have figured that this Enlightenment osmosis that he saw that was going to take place would, in time, transform the American population at large into Unitarians. And as we say, he believed this would be accomplished within the generation that was coming of age in his life, even as his life was coming to an end. Well, as to Jefferson's prediction, it's a little like that car rental commercial used to put it. Not exactly. For even as he wrote those words, a movement called the Second Great Awakening was getting underway with very emotion-laden sin and salvation revival meetings, some of them lasting for days, were sweeping across the American landscape in this newly born country. And then following the Civil War, as the modern scientific era began to dawn, there was a very strong religiously based reaction to it as people felt their belief structures and their moral foundations were being undermined by the new currents of thought, new ways of perceiving the world and our place in it. That movement was called fundamentalism, and it is still with us today. Well, Jefferson, to make one more pass at him, was such a strong believer in the power of ideas, power of the mind, that he felt that promoting and extending a religion like, say, Unitarianism was simply a matter of may the best idea or the may the most intellectually defensible beliefs win, as he assumed the ideas and beliefs of Unitarianism would. And the place where he had that blind spot to which I referred a few minutes ago was that he failed to, I think, fully understand or fully appreciate just what a complex, multi-layered phenomenon religion, any religion, really is. It is not just something you buy with your mind. For it to really work, for it to have real meaning and impact in a person's life, it has to be something that's internalized into one's whole being. Well, I'd like you to file that point for future reference, because it's one I'll come back to a little bit later. For now, I have to wonder, had Jefferson somehow managed to live for several more decades, if not century, beyond his death in 1826, I wonder if he would have asked, how come Unitarianism isn't growing the way I thought it would? Well, even he didn't get a chance to ask that question. Plenty of other Unitarians, and now since 1961, Unitarian Universalists certainly have. It is the question that the troika of Phil Brown, Harry Perkheiser, and Jim McCormick put forth when they collectively entered the highest bid at last year's service auction, where one of my donations was a sermon topic of one's choosing. I made two donations to the auction, a sermon topic of one's choosing. Amy, I'll get these to you in coffee hours so you can add two more to the list. A sermon topic of one's choosing, and that I paint a room in someone's home. I guess those are my true skills, right? Well, I painted the room last summer, so now I'm getting around with the auction 2 weeks away. This is kind of under the wire, but I'm getting that done. And do get your service recommendations to Amy. The sermon topic these three folk asked for was that they even gave me a title, which is the title of today's sermon, the UU Conundrum. And the conundrum to which these high-rolling gentlemen refer was put to me in an email from one of them some months ago in these words: "We're thoughtful, relevant, and non-dogmatic. If we are so tolerant, welcoming, and relevant, why aren't there more of us?" That's probably not too far off the mark from how Jefferson himself would have put it. Well, I guess the easy way out for me at this point will be to say, "Well, done, God, if I know," and sing the closing hymn and give these guys their money back. Well, I'm done yet. No, really, it is on a more serious note. It is a question that bedevils me as well. It will be 30 years ago this fall that I was granted entry into the UU ministry by our association. And in that time, I have seen our association launch various growth campaigns and advertising campaigns and promotional campaigns, even as the numbers across our denomination have stayed more or less flat. Now, this does not make me a cynic, I should quickly point out, when it comes to growth. I'm still in here pitching, after all, and doing so with a very fine congregation. But I would have to say that those 30 years have at least given me some perspective that might be helpful in getting at this question. I don't just want to answer the question, I want to say what I think it would take to grow our faith in some significant ways. Well, true to my style, I first like to look at the big picture. And this time, the big picture was very fortuitously handed to me, along with all other interested persons, about 5-6 weeks ago, when the Pew Forum on Religion and Public Life released the results of one of the more comprehensive surveys ever done on the nature and scope of religion in America today. I know there is nothing that can make the eyes glaze over more quickly in a sermon than for me to start doing a bunch of number crunching, so I'm going to try to stay away from that and at least still do some justice to this survey. To boil it down to a single sentence, our religious, as a country, as a nation, as a culture, society, our religious views and attitudes and affiliations in this country are all over the place at the moment and in a state of very high flux. To get at some of the numbers behind that finding, only 30% of our population now claim affiliation with the faith in which they were raised. So when we look at our own family and we see that about 20% of today's Unitarian Universalists are birthright UUs, we're really not that far off the national average when it comes to the makeup of our congregations. And in the category of misery loves company, both the mainline moderate to liberal Protestant Christian denominations, as well as Roman Catholicism, have been in a more or less kind of flatline plateau state for the past 15 to 20 years. In fact, the only thing that is keeping our Catholic friends from losing ground has been the number of Catholic immigrants coming into this country during that period of time, and who probably are looking for some kind of a safe and secure and familiar anchor in what I'm sure is a new and strange land for them. If it weren't for that, the Catholic population would have actually fallen more than the Protestant one. Yeah, I was not surprised also to learn that it is the evangelical Protestant Christians, who are not all that strong on denominational affiliation, that are growing, especially with their non-denominational mega churches, even as the more mainline, as I say, moderate to liberal Protestant denominations pretty much tread water. But the intriguing piece for me in all of this research was what I called the rise of the unaffiliates. The fastest growing religious body in this country right now is not a definitively religious body at all, but rather an amorphous group comprising 25% of the population, no less, who do not claim affiliation or relationship with any religious body or any faith tradition. Now, these folks are not primarily atheists or agnostics. There are some among them, but that's not what their primary makeup is. They're more like spiritual seekers for whom the idea of God, or a higher power, or a life force, or a life spirit, however vaguely defined it may be for them, and however they may variously name it, that is in some way meaningful to them. They just haven't found a place to go with those kinds of beliefs, those kinds of seekings. These folk are not looking for an escape from religion or an escape from belief, but instead looking for a place where they can be authentically religious, be authentic believers, and find a spiritual path that resonates with who they are and where they want to take their lives, even as they're still working that out. And so I'm convinced that if we UUs are going to get out of our flatline state, which is a state we share, as I already pointed out, with both mainline Protestantism and Roman Catholicism, granted our numbers are infinitely smaller than theirs, we're all about the same place as far as our growth goes, I think we're going to have to, excuse me, there's some things we're going to have to come to terms with within our own family. What we offer by way of liberal religion is not going to work or appeal to all of them. But there's enough, I believe, of those 25% unaffiliateds that could be brought into our congregations. But as I just said, there's some hurdles we're going to have to clear, some understandings I think we're going to have to come to if that's going to happen. Otherwise, all the ad campaigns in the world, however well done, and as much as I do support them, are not probably going to help us all that much. Our Unitarian Universalist Association is running another of its ads in this week's Time magazine. I've seen it. It's a very good one. It appears to be aimed right at those unaffiliateds. And I don't want what I just said or what I will say to detract from that in any way. What I am suggesting is that there are some things we need to be, I think, a bit clearer with ourselves about, as I say, within our family now, if what we're putting out to the larger world is going to affect our ranks in any significant ways. Let me turn to that. First of all, I think we have to get past that blind spot of Jefferson's, to which I referred earlier. The power of a good idea, or a set of good ideas, by themselves, will not grow us. I think we've overly relied on that in some ways. Remember, Jefferson felt all it would take would be for these Unitarian Enlightenment ideas to permeate the population, and everyone would just jump into the Unitarian boat. Now, the three people who requested this sermon were quite correct in describing Unitarian Universalism today as thoughtful, tolerant, relevant, and non-dogmatic. These were, in fact, the ideas that brought me into the Unitarian Universalist fold itself when I was looking for a place to continue in the ministry. What kept me here, however, was finding a community and a faith tradition that I knew I could connect with and with which I could feel a close identity with all the parts of my being, mind, soul, and spirit. Because you see, and this goes for any one of us, I can be a thoughtful, tolerant, relevant, non-dogmatic person without ever walking through the door of a religious community, this one or any other. This is why I have come to believe that religion of any kind, clear across the conservative to liberal spectrum, is really more caught than it is taught. And I say that as someone who loves to teach, both here in this church and in other settings. And by caught, I mean one has to see, sense, and feel that there is a culture here that I can connect with when she or he comes in to one of our congregations. That's why I mean by caught, not taught. When I talk to people who have been longtime Unitarian Universalists and say, how did you find us? People say, well, I heard some things about it. I thought it was a good idea. But then when I came to a congregation, I really felt like this was a place for me. Remember, going from thinking to feeling. And if that transition doesn't happen, then we pretty much stay where we are. I wish I had a little more time to develop this point with a couple of other areas I want to get to. I'll just say for now that all the great and wonderful ideas in the world, in and of themselves, are not going to keep a person attached to a religious community, however liberal it may be, unless they also develop a sense of relationship and a sense of connection with those who are in that community. And I think that's where our efforts really need to be. I think we do a pretty good job of attracting people here. The challenge is the kind of, not just the challenge, not just for this congregation, but for our UU congregations across the country. The challenge for all of us is, what kind of home do we offer once we get people into the house? Okay, for my next point, let me offer the metaphor of a lifeboat. Since I think, as I read back to that Pew survey again, I think that's what a good number of these unaffiliated folks are looking for. Maybe not thrashing around like they're drowning, but still looking for some kind of a lifeboat. They would welcome one that will come along, whether they're actively looking for one or not. To jump into that evangelical side for just a moment, one reason I think the evangelical sector of our population is growing right now is because they're putting a pretty good lifeboat out there. Think about it. All of us. We live in a pretty overwhelming world right now. Maybe everyone felt they lived in an overwhelming world, but I think it's true especially today. We deal with economic insecurities. We deal with concerns about how well or not we're raising our families, what kind of grounding we're giving our children. We deal with shifting codes and norms of moral and ethical behavior. Religious beliefs, as already indicated, are very much in flux. You know, what's really true and what's not. We can take that up to the national and global concerns about how safe and secure of a country we live in, how safe and secure of a world we inhabit. Well, if you think of all that as a sea of uncertainty, for someone who feels like they're drowning in it, just about any lifeboat that comes along is going to look pretty good. And that evangelical lifeboat, and since I grew up in one, I have a pretty good idea what it looks like and what's in it, offers a prescribed way of believing, a well-defined way of looking at the world and your place and your role in it, a well-defined layout of what is right and wrong, moral and immoral, and in most cases, a group of happy and loving and enthusiastic people who all feel the same way about these things. You better believe that's attractive. And giving credit where it's due, there is, in many sectors of that lifeboat anyway, a social conscience where Jesus' admonitions about caring for the hungry and clothing the naked and caring for the earth are taken pretty seriously. All in all, it's a pretty attractive, safe, and secure lifeboat. And if the Pew survey is anyway correct, a lot of folks are climbing on board. Okay, for those of us in the UU camp, I would say we can waste a lot of time bemoaning all the people who are hopping into this lifeboat, or we can devote attention and energy and effort into what we might put on our own and what we are putting on our own. There are, after all, as I said before, I think a lot of folks in that unaffiliated sea who would welcome such a boat as ours. We want to keep in it, to be sure, the things I've already talked about: thoughtfulness, a free mind, intellectual integrity, along with tolerance and relevance and non-dogmatism. If those things should ever get tossed overboard, I guess I'm going to have to go with them, since they're the things that got me here and got me into the boat in the first place. But along with such attributes as these, there also has to be a safe and accepting place for searching and finding in our boat. If people wish to speak of faith and seek out a God or a spirit or a life force that's meaningful for them and grounds their lives, whatever they wish to call it, those opportunities need to be in our boat. Because as I noted earlier, these unaffiliated folks are not looking for an escape from religion as much as a place where they can openly and authentically be about finding a religious and a spiritual grounding for themselves. One example: I've been very impressed over the last several weeks by the number of people who have been showing up here on Thursday nights attending our Spirit in Practice series that Cynthia and Adam are leading. The first night, some 35 people showed up for that. It stayed pretty close to that on the succeeding nights. That's close to 10% of our congregation. We put out a thing called Spiritual Practices, and the thing about Spiritual Practices is about 10% of us show up for it. Such a response tells me that a place for spiritual journey making and guidance and direction need to be in our boat, because this is the biggest response we've had to any kind of a gold offering in the 20 years that I've been a minister here. Well, I'm aware that what I've offered is really the beginning of a conversation that we Unitarian Universalists need to be having, both among ourselves and, equally important, with those who are checking us out to see what's in our boat and trying to decide if they want to climb in or not. So I hope that you will consider, even as I'm having to get to the end of this sermon, I hope you will consider this the beginning and take up the continuation of such a conversation. I'm going to wind this down for today with an observation by Dr. Houston Smith, which he makes in the opening chapter of a book he wrote called Why Religion Matters. Dr. Smith, whom I've had the pleasure of meeting and conversing with, is a very delightful and engaging guy. He now lives in Berkeley after teaching religion and philosophy at a number of our universities, including MIT. Here's a paragraph of his I want to hold up. Wherever people live, whenever they live, they find themselves faced with three inescapable problems. First, how to win food and shelter from their natural environment, the problem nature poses. Second, how to get along with each other, the social problem. And third, how to relate themselves to the total scheme of things, the religious problem. Smith goes on, if this third issue seems less important than the other two, we should remind ourselves that religious artifacts are the oldest that archaeologists have discovered. Okay, we all have to attend to our physical survival, figure out how to get food, shelter, protection. We have to figure out. We often struggle with it, we fail, and we try again, but we keep struggling to find ways to live with one another in a reasonably safe and secure world. That's what Smith calls the social problem. And then, as he puts it, there's the equally compelling challenge of determining and discovering how are we going to live with and how we're going to relate to what Dr. Smith calls the total scheme of things. He calls that the religious problem. We could also call it the problem of meaning, or the challenge of the spirit. Who am I? Where am I? Why am I? In the total scheme of things. These are questions for our minds, for our intellect, questions for our spirits, questions for our souls, questions that we work out in communion and community with each other. They are questions that touch both the head and the heart, and we have to find the answers in both places. There are questions and challenges that have always drawn human beings into religious communities. We are one such very small, but still I feel very vital, very important religious community in the much larger landscape of the society and the culture in which we live. If we tend to it well, it will continue to have its rightful place in that larger scheme of things as we seek to continue to offer here what our closing hymn calls us to sing about, a place where we touch the earth and reach the sky. It's number 301. Let's sing that together.